This is Vandana Shiva, and you're listening to The Enviro Show. Remember, listen to your mother.
Do you find yourself longing for the apocalypse? I did. I was looking for a reason to live. Hi. Are you feeling tired, irritable, stressed out? Well, you might consider nature.
From the people that brought you Getting Outside comes prescription-strength Nature, a non-harmful medication shown to relieve the crippling symptoms of modern life.
Nature's recommended for humans of all ages, and it's great for pets, too.
Nature can reduce cynicism, meaninglessness, anal retentiveness, and murderous rage. In clinical studies, Nature is proven to decrease work-induced catatonia.
Caution. Nature may cause you to slow down, quit your job, or seriously consider what the f*** you're doing with your life.
If you are overly cynical, jaded, or emotionally numb, you may need to increase your dose of Nature. Do you have trouble being even mildly uncomfortable? Nature may not be right for you. Side effects may include spontaneous euphoria, taking yourself less seriously, and being in a good mood for no apparent reason.
So ask your doctor if Nature is right for you.
It's the Enviro Show. Greetings, Earthlings. It's a Fungus Among Us Enviro Show. I am one of your co-hosts, Dio, and I'm not in the studio with...
Yes, I'm a fungi, Glenn Ayers.
And I never knew how much of a fungi fan you were, Glenn. And we are bringing in the new year with news of yet another invasive species. No, it's not the present gold-obsessed occupants of the White House, but rather invasive golden oyster mushrooms, or GOM, G-O-M. A new study finds it is changing native fungal biodiversity as it invades. GOM has spread rapidly in North America and will continue expanding its range. And that's a quote. Unlike MAGA, that is losing its range by the day, Aishwarya Veerabahu, a lead author of the study that joins us to forge the facts, will be with us. As always, we will also introduce you to our fool on the hill, those whose brains were small, as well as the ever-present reminder that it's the climate crisis, stupid, and more. But first, it's time for... Revenge of the Critters, Biker versus Grizz. This is a long and sordid tale, so I can only give you a little of it, but you can go to the blog, and that's Enviro Show without the W, .blogspot.com, and click on the link. When I came around the corner on my bike and spotted a grizzly bear, I had seen two or three black bears before, and usually if you make noise, they move away. But this was the first time I had seen a grizzly, and it was staring at me. I got off my bike, since it wasn't moving. I was peering out of the corner of my eye and noticed it slinking towards me until it was only a couple feet away. It had almost cleared past my bike until it made a 180-degree turn towards me. I spun around to put the bike between us, and got my hiking pole out. As it moved closer, placing it between its eyes, it pushed back a little, and that seemed like a decent stalemate until it rolled its head and bit on the pole and tossed it away. I took off my bag and threw it to the side. I thought it would go after the food in there instead of me. It took a sniff, but then started prodding me with its paw. Each poke got a little more aggressive until it lifted its paw high. I thought it would inflict some serious damage, so I threw my bike at it. The grizzly bear, it lunged forward and sank its teeth between my ribs and hips on my left side, and as soon as I was in the bear's mouth, it carried me 30 to 40 feet towards the bush. And there's more to that story, but you'll have to go to the blog and click on the link to hear the whole scary story.
But he lived to tell the tale, huh?
Did.
Wow.
One lucky biker.
Yeah, that's like a, I don't know what to say, probably a peak experience, a lifetime achievement. Attacked by a grizzly and to survive, that's got to be one that you remember for the rest of your life.
A serious case of PTSD. How about we move on? And their brains were small. Maybe my brain's a little small.
They were big, dumb, and slow.
They couldn't go with the flow.
Their brains were small and they died.
Let's start out the new year with a herd mentality of elected officials for our "Their Brains Are Small and They Died" segment, even though they've yet to die. It's actually quite easy because the Center for American Progress has done all the work with, quote, "A new CAP analysis finds that the federal government is rife with officials who deny climate change in leadership positions within the executive branch, presidential cabinet, and Congress." Close quote. Surprise. Quote, "These elected officials have also received a total of $51,449,854. Is that all? In lifetime contributions from the fossil fuel industry. So, you know, we may as well remind them in 2026 that it's still the climate crisis, stupid. The administration has created a government built on policies to dismantle climate science, and appointed, and the Senate has confirmed, climate deniers and skeptics to the presidential cabinet, even as the total number of members of Congress who overtly deny climate science has declined slightly. This analysis finds that the current 119th Congress, climate deniers hold 69% of leadership positions in Congress, the executive branch, and the cabinet. Close quote. Let's move on, Fool on the Hill.
And nobody seems to like him, the Fool on the Hill.
She's back. This week's Fool on the Hill is repeat offender, Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, who, in the service of gun-happy ranchers out west, has introduced the Pet and Livestock Protection Act. If, quote, Representative Lauren Boebert's legislation passes the Senate and becomes law, thousands more wolves will be in the crosshairs. This will open the door to recreational wolf hunting across the lower 48, especially in the upper Midwest states of Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, notes Environmental Action. Only a fool would up the ante in the war against nature. Okay, go to the blog. There's an Enviro Show Action link on that one.
Obviously, Lauren Boebert has not started thinking like a mountain.
Not at all.
No.
Why don't you tell the listeners where that quote comes from?
Well, that's an Aldo Leopold essay, Thinking Like a Mountain. And it is about when he was young, and he says when he was young and trigger happy, he and a bunch of, I think, Forest Service employees saw a pack of wolves, and they let loose with their rifles, killing or wounding the entire pack, which crawled off into the boulders. But one of the wolves, I think the main leader of the pack, survived long enough for them to get up and have a look at her while she died. And he watched the fierce green fire in her eyes fade away. And that is, it's a classic essay by Aldo Leopold. And what the point of the essay is that he was thinking that less wolves would mean more hooved meat, more elk, more deer. But it turned out that when you get rid of the wolves, all the deer and elk do is strip all of the trees until there's nothing left. And then they all die because they run out of food. And it was the wolves that were balancing the ecology and keeping the deer and elk and other critters, the herbivores, it was keeping them in check so that they wouldn't overrun the carrying capacity. And so Thinking Like a Mountain was thinking from the perspective of the mountain, what's best for the ecology and for the sustainability of the mountain? And that is to have animals in balance and not to remove the top predators, which causes a cascade of negative impacts. It's worth reading. He does a better job of explaining it. Beautiful writer, Aldo Leopold. And really, I think, you know, one of the great books of all time, A Sand County Almanac, where that essay is found.
True classic. Okay, let's move on to the double speak of the week.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and our press secretary, Sean Spicer, gave alternative facts.
Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Our double speak of the week comes from a podcaster who is on the case. On September 22nd, 2025, the president signed an executive order dismantling Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization. A few days later, he issued National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, that's NSPM 7, entitled Countering Domestic Terrorism and Organized Political Violence, which alleged without any evidence that Antifa was responsible for a wide range of unrelated acts of violence, such as the assassination of Charlie Kirk and anti-ICE protests. But as the Brennan Center for Justice explains, both former FBI Director Chris Wray and the Congressional Research Service have determined that Antifa does not exist as a group or an organization. Actually, a vast majority of our fellow citizens are opposed to the rise in fascism in the Republican Party. Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, I think his malignancy is opposed to anyone who is anti-fascist because he is a fascist. So, of course, he would claim that anyone opposed to that is a terrorist. But, you know, of course, that's the complete opposite of reality. He's the terrorist. He's terrorizing everyone. And by allowing him to continue on his march towards fascism, well, that's where everyone needs to be anti-fascist. And it's happening. The opposition is growing daily. And so I say that we're all Antifa. We are all part of the opposition, and we're getting stronger every day.
Really? Read the history, folks. World War II, your grandfather or grandmother, or maybe your father or mother, they fought against fascism in the 40s. And the nation was opposed to it. We went to war, and we threw fascists in the garbage. End of story. Look it up. Okay. Speaking of his malignancy, the Mad King. No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA. No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA. Hashtag no kings. Here's more of the same. The administration is about to embark on a massive crackdown on what it describes as a scourge of rampant left-wing terrorism. But the U.S. Department of Justice memo ordering the crackdown has critics fearing it will go far beyond punishing those who plan criminal acts and will instead be used to criminalize anyone who expresses opposition to the president and his agenda, the piece goes on to say. As part of this effort, Attorney General Bondi set a deadline for all law enforcement agencies to coordinate delivery of intelligence files related to Antifa or Antifa-related activities to the FBI. The memo identifies those who express opposition to law and immigration enforcement, extreme views in favor of mass migration and open borders, adherence to radical gender ideology, as well as, quote, anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity as potential targets for investigation. Wait, Glenn, given the language in the U.S. Constitution, isn't it anti-American to write an act on such a memo? But looking back, all the damage his malignancy has done in terms of the climate crisis, the New York Times and a friend of the show has given us this, not a happy reading, but go to the blog, click on the link, and that's followed up by another action link.
Oof. Yeah, wow. Well, his malignancy, what can you say? He is setting the standard for one of the most malignant narcissist persons of the century, really, of the past couple of centuries. And it's amazing, you know, that this malignant narcissist has the support that he does, even though, again, it is getting smaller and smaller every day. That's right. It's still incredible.
Yep. It's like the line between fact and fiction has vanished. Okay, how about moving on to some good news? Our critter of the week.
We all are animals. We all are animals.
So our critter of the week is just right for this time and space. And we could use a little magic these days. And the ABC of birds tells us, quote, considered sacred by several Mesoamerican civilizations, the resplendent quetzal remains culturally significant to this day. Resplendent quetzal likely inspired Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of Mesoamerica. Legend has it that Quetzalcoatl helped create Earth. Rulers and nobility wore headdresses made from the quetzal's shining green feathers, which symbolically connected them to the god. In some Mesoamerican cultures, it was considered a crime to kill a quetzal, so the blooms were procured by capturing the bird and plucking its long tail feathers and setting it free. In several Mesoamerican languages, the term for quetzal can also mean precious or sacred. The post goes on. This spectacular species belongs to the trogon family, a group of colorful fruit-eating birds found in the Americas, Asia, and Africa. The male resplendent quetzal is an unforgettable sight, shimmering with metallic greens and blues above and bright red below, the sporting a bristly-looking crest of golden green feathers. But during the breeding season, the male's upper tail feathers grow into a flowing green train that can reach up to 3 feet long. You can hear clips of the quetzal song on the blog. Go to the blog, click on the link, hear that, and it's a pretty amazing bird. Okay, how about we continue moving into 2026 with more good news? First off, there's a study just out showing, quote, rising levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are a major driver of climate change. At the same time, the higher CO2 concentrations can encourage plants to grow faster, which in turn can help slow warming by drawing down more carbon out of the air. So this is what we thought all along, and I guess this study sort of reinforces that. But if that's too sciencey, how about this? Go to blog and click on Billionaires Are Actually Good, and it's Stephen Colbert and friends, and it's such a hoot. No? Maybe too much of a hoop. Maybe you need a pep talk. Go to the blog and click on that link. Or we can just stick with good old panel cartoons like Tom Tomorrow. Go to the blog and click on those links. You know what they say about laughter, right? It comes in with our quote of the week. Okay, you may be familiar with this one. The human race has only one really effective weapon, and that is laughter. And that's from Mark Twain. And I think that brings us to our interview.
Yes, well, we won't be laughing after we hear this interview, but I'm going to try to spin it a little bit and say it is actually a positive interview, because the positive take-home message for me was that there are still a lot of people that care about nature and care about protecting nature and biodiversity. And our guest, Aishwarya, is one of those people. And I was particularly impressed by her enthusiasm for addressing these things that you could look at and go, oh, it's doom and gloom. But instead, she's addressing it and raising awareness. And I think that that's really the thing that's encouraging for me, is that younger people are really looking at the problems around them and identifying what the cause is, and then coming up with kind of ideas. Well, how can we change our behavior? What do we need to do to prevent this? And this is a tragic story, obviously, about invasive species, which wreak havoc on the environment and the native communities of plants and animals. In this case, we're talking about fungi. That's a kind of a small part that is often overlooked, and we talk about that during the interview. So let's get into that interview. I found it fascinating. I could have talked with her all day. Today on the Enviro Show, we are very pleased to be joined by Aishwarya Veerabahu, who I found out about by reading a paper that she recently was the lead author on, called Invasive Golden Oyster Mushrooms Are Disrupting Native Fungal Communities as They Spread Throughout North America. And Aishwarya wrote this with a team of people, and you can tell us more about that, Aishwarya, and what brought you to look at this issue of invasive fungi. Now, here in Massachusetts, we have lots of invasive plants. We are overrun by bittersweet and barberry, you know, non-native species, and knotweed. And oh, the list goes on, where our forests and wetlands are being overrun by loosestrife, purple loosestrife, right, all kinds of plants that cause tremendous environmental harm, kind of outcompete or displace native species. And this is the first time I've heard about this golden oyster mushroom, which we do have a native oyster mushroom here in Massachusetts, but mm-hmm. this is an exotic introduced species that is outcompeting our native ones. So again, do a quick introduction of yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what brought you to study invasive fungi. This opens up a whole world that I hadn't even thought of. And I'll tell you that just earlier this year, Massachusetts released a biodiversity report, wrote, and it's a 38-page document about protecting biodiversity. And I read it yesterday, and they never mention fungi, and especially invasive fungi. So tell us a little bit about it. Tell us about yourself, and then let's get into talking about these invasive fungi.
Yeah, sure thing. First of all, thank you so much for having me on this show. My name is Aishwarya, and I'm a PhD student in the Botany Department, soon to become Department of Biology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I study fungal ecology. And the way that I came to invasive fungi in particular was really kind of as I was about to join Ann Pringle's lab, I talked to her and I told her I'm interested in studying fungal biodiversity broadly. And at first, I was kind of interested in more like the restoration aspect of it. But in the field of mycology, I think I would say that restoration is still kind of a smaller up-and-coming field and has a lot of research left to be done. But Anne's expertise, particularly, is in invasive fungi. And so she said, think about coming at biodiversity from the other direction of how to study the things that are affecting it and how to prevent loss of fungal biodiversity in the first place. That was a very different angle of looking at biodiversity, and I actually kind of really like that. I've fully come around to being more on the preventative rather than restorative side of things, though both very much have their place. So that's kind of how I got into this.
And Aishwarya, the whole concept of these invasive fungi in this particular study that you did, there's this golden oyster mushroom, which is being not intentionally introduced, but escaping from cultivation. And I have to tell you that I was a mushroom cultivator for many years. I grew many kinds of mushrooms, including oyster mushrooms. So I was growing the native Pleurotus oyster mushrooms. And I actually have never eaten or heard of these golden oyster mushrooms, but they're a non-native, not to the US, to other parts of the world. But now people are growing them because they're very easy to grow. They grow very aggressively, but they've escaped. And that seems to be the problem, is that we're introducing unintentionally, or maybe intentionally, introducing these non-native species. And they're sort of like a plant pathogen in a certain way, that they're being exposed to areas that are not used to them. And so, can you tell us a little bit about the whole concept of these invasive fungi being distributed around the world?
Yeah, I think, like you kind of hit on, a huge part of it has to do with cultivation. That is not the only way that fungi get introduced to new regions around the world. I would say another huge industry that has brought invasive mushrooms in particular, like Favolosha calicera, the orange ping pong bat fungus, and Amanita muscaria, the famous Mario mushroom, fly agaric, red with white spots. Those two mushrooms are also invasive in parts of the world, and that has been moved around due to the timber industry. And so that's one of, I would say, the oldest and first industries that kind of started to move fungi around because the fungi were associated with whatever plants were being shipped to new places, whatever plants and trees were being moved around, and also existed in whatever timber was being moved around. And then, of course, as of kind of the turn of the century here, as mushrooms have gotten more popular in kind of cuisines around the world, it's definitely turned into this game of let's try and cultivate as many edible mushrooms as we can. And the golden oyster stands out in that way because it's this beautiful bright yellow color. So it's kind of very like charismatic and easy on the eyes. And like you said, it grows really fast. And we're unsure whether that is a trait of the species kind of like from the beginning, like has it always been that way in nature, even in the native range? Or is that something that has been selected for over time in the process of being cultivated? The other thing that you brought up is, right, this is kind of the first big escapee that we have seen in the mushroom cultivation industry. So it's not the only non-native mushroom we're moving around. There are other oyster mushrooms, even, that are not native to North America, like the pink oyster, for example. But we're growing a lot of these different types of mushrooms, and like you said, the spore load can be so heavy on folks. And so it's a general practice in mushroom farms to vent their facilities. And so that comes up as one source of potential introduction, is a lot of these mushroom cultivation factories, in order to try and make breathing conditions easier on their workers, they've got to vent their facilities, and that's billions, probably trillions of spores going out into the environment every day. And then comes in the whole little technology of mushroom kits, which is so lovely. I think they've brought so much joy and introduce so many people to the world of mushrooms, which can remain a happy, wonderful thing forever. But an unintended consequence of that in the case of the golden oysters has been that, you know, if people are putting their kit outside or something, just the wind can carry those spores right into their nearby forests. And so that's another potential source of introduction. And then another one is, people have been so excited about mushrooms that, especially one like this that grows on dead wood, you might think to inoculate it in logs in your backyard or something, the way that people do with, let's say, like shiitake mushrooms. And so that could also be kind of like another method of introduction. So that's kind of the story of how it happened, or at least we'll never know exactly how it happened, but those are all the ways that it could have happened and likely did. And so around the beginning of the 2010s, the first report I've ever heard someone talk about in Iowa was in 2014, they saw golden oysters growing wild. And so that's kind of the time frame we're looking at. And then from 2014 onwards, it has really just taken 6 to 8 years for it to totally spread across the Midwest and Northeast of North America.
This is really amazing, because as a former mushroom cultivator, not commercially, I just did it as a hobby. When I was a graduate school, I had access to an autoclave and all kinds of lab equipment, and sure, I grew all kinds of mushrooms. I made mushroom boxes, like the kinds you can buy and give to people, but yeah, I made them myself and then gave them away to people. And most of the ones, I'm thinking that I can probably say this because it's been 35 or 40 years, most of them were psilocybin mushroom boxes.
Nice.
And I gave those away to so many people who grew psilocybin mushrooms for recreational purposes. And back then it was illegal. Now they're trying to make it legal in a lot of places. But anyway, I was doing this on a pretty good scale. And I never thought for a minute about the fact that I was unintentionally perhaps spreading these spores all over the place. I was mostly dealing with what I would say were native species or wild species that I was cultivating.
Okay.
But this idea of bringing mushrooms from all around the world to cultivate them, and then who knows what happens to them, that is really kind of a scary thought, that the unintended consequences of this. And I noticed reading your paper, which I highly recommend to everybody. It's very easy to read. It's very well written and digestible. But you mention in there the fact that you're using kind of citizen science or crowdsourced information about the spread of this mushroom from apps such as Mushroom Observer, which is an open source app that people can keep track of all the types of mushrooms, and people will help identify the mushroom if you can't. And then iNaturalist, which is another app on a smartphone. And so can you talk about the use of that kind of citizen science crowdsourced information in a pretty scientific setting, like this kind of a report that is published in a scientific journal?
Yeah, absolutely. My project would not exist without community and citizen science, period. In a sense, because when some of the mycologists here in the Midwest were starting to hear and see golden oyster, it was kind of like, for the story that I hear, at least from my professor, is like, it was a conversation amongst professors, but really what it was people emailing professors and saying, hey, I've been foraging here in Iowa, Wisconsin for 20 years, and I've never seen this thing here. And now it's all of a sudden I'm seeing it like everywhere in this particular forest or in this county. And so it was definitely that word of mouth. And I think just The lovely community of mycologists that we have out there and mushroom lovers that were in tune with their surroundings. And then, you know, eventually combining the technology part of that, of posting their observations on sites like iNaturalist and Mushroom Observer, allowed us to really get a scale and a sense of the rate of that spread. Otherwise, right, it's just kind of hearsay with no data points. And so it has been absolutely incredible to work with a data set like that and to encourage people to go out there and keep looking for it. There are ways to deal with the population density bias, because I'm certainly not the first person to work with citizen and community science data like this. And so there are ways to kind of like filter through that and remove the bias of human observation, or like the likelihood that you're going to see it closer to cities, right? Like if you go pull up the map of golden oyster observations on, say, iNaturalist right now, you're going to, of course, see it clustered closer to cities like Madison or Columbus or Philadelphia. And so there are ways to deal with that. And I think another really important aspect of this being such a community science project, even the fact that this project feels like it belongs to everybody and not just me, is I think that it can help counter any odd sense of guilt that we might have around having like moved a species around, or if we were cultivators in the past, or if we had bought and used and grown a golden oyster grow kit. I want everyone to know that there is no blame or guilt that needs to be had. All there is to just find a solution together and move forward with it. I'd say maybe 99% of the population did not know that something like this could happen, right? Kind of like you were mentioning with the biodiversity report. Fungi don't get mentioned. It's really caught storm in our popular culture and in this popular moment, but still there are so many places where mycologists love to go rabble, rabble, rabble. They didn't include fungi. And I'm gonna love every last day that I still get to rabble about that. But the fact of it is that they are often forgotten in biodiversity assessments. And I think similarly, they have been very forgotten in the conversation about invasive species. We do have a sense of them when we talk about fungal plant pathogens. Of course, we've thought of them in terms of Dutch elm disease and fungal pathogens of crops and anything like that. But invasive mushrooms is a bit of a new one.
Aishwarya, Dio here. You mentioned solution. Could you tell our listeners what a solution might look like?
Yeah, I think one of the first solutions, and I think it's kind of a beautiful one, is really get to know your native edible mushrooms. Like, if you love to grow or eat mushrooms, immerse yourself in the mushrooms that grow around your place and get to know them and when they pop out and look for them. I think it's kind of such a wholesome way to get to know your surroundings a bit more, get to know mycology a bit more, and then also participate in a local tradition of mycology, mycophagy, of a local tradition of eating mushrooms.
So most people don't understand fungi, and even more so, they don't understand the ecological role that fungi play in just in the environment in general, especially in forested areas. Can you talk a little bit about the role that fungi, I mean, on a broad level, but how important fungi are to recycling all of the material in the forest and all of the nutrients? I mean, I know about ectomycorrhizae and the association that almost all higher plants form with fungi, but most people just don't know how important fungi are.
Yeah, they are incredibly important because of the fine scale that they work on. So they do so much recycling, like you mentioned, of pretty much like all the major elements that would first come to your mind, of carbon in the form of all of our wood decomposer fungi and saprobes, right? They're breaking down dead material like leaf litter. Wood decomposers are breaking down wood, and they are the most efficient organisms on earth at breaking down particularly carbon that's locked up in lignin. Like, lignin is a really crazy complex molecule. It has like no repeating structure. And so that's not something that nature normally like is good at dealing with. An enzyme is out there expecting a repeating structure that it can just keep snipping, in a repeated pattern. But lignin isn't like that. It's a whole hodgepodge of carbon mixed together. But fungi are able to break that up. I mean, we have petagrams of carbon locked up in dead wood. And so fungi are the primary ones that are able to recycle that carbon back into the soil. Part of it gets recycled back into the atmosphere, and I would say the other major part of it goes into the fungal body. And then the other part of it is in soil, they're also helping move elements like nitrogen and phosphorus, a lot of times in the process of being mycorrhizally associated with plants. That is one whole kind of, let's say, inorganic and organic part of what they deal with, is with all of these elements like carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. But another huge part of their ecological roles is their interactions with other organisms, right? So we already kind of mentioned the associations with plants, even associations that are negative, quote unquote, like pathogen and parasitic relationships are incredibly important as well. Like, I was reading this paper not too long ago about how plant pathogens in tropical rainforests are one of the leading reasons why you see so much plant diversity, is because you can't have too much of any one plant. And it's, so it ends up leading to beautiful things like the plant diversity that we see in the tropics. And so the interactions that they have with invertebrates, with birds, with mammals. There's just, I could go on and on and on, but they do tons of things. And I think we're still only on the tip of the iceberg of the true breadth of ecological roles they play.
We talk a lot on this show about the climate emergency, and that has to do with having too much mostly fossil fuel carbon in the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide from burning stuff. But also the forest respires,
Right.
and all living things release carbon dioxide as part of respiration. And so what's the potential impact of having such an aggressive type of fungus that outcompetes other fungi that are maybe in balance? Let's say we have this super aggressive wood decomposing fungus that outcompetes other things and maybe decomposes wood and lignin faster and releases more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. On scale, is that something to be concerned about?
I am concerned about it. I think that is definitely something that is still waiting to be figured out. I really hope someone out there kind of takes this aspect of the project and runs with it, of trying to see like how fast is golden oyster really like decaying wood, and how much carbon dioxide is it respiring in that process? Because I will tell you that the reason why I'm concerned, without any data having been generated about that question yet, is that when you go out into forests here, you see golden oyster on sometimes on every dead tree in the vicinity. And it's just shocking to see. And there's a particular tree in this park right next to my house, and that tree was probably the widest diameter tree there. I haven't been able to wrap my arms completely around it. So I moved close to this park 2 years ago, and I saw golden oyster on it the first summer that I was here. And I asked the man whose house faces that tree, I said, "When did you first see this pop up?" And he said, "Oh, I think about maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, and I first saw it pop up high on the tree." And I said, "Oh, that's fascinating. I'm doing my PhD on this mushroom, and it's actually an invasive mushroom that eats through wood really rapidly." And guess what, Glenn? I went to that tree this past summer and it's fallen down. It just, I mean, it was so really quite thick of a trunk. And to think that in just like 5, 6 years, it's been brought down, I was both surprised and also completely unsurprised. So So that's the main reason, is it can chew through wood really fast. We've just seen it hop onto cottonwood. It can grow on black cherry. It can grow on maple, red oak. It's really jumped onto types of wood that I wouldn't have necessarily expected it to. Like, I went and looked at the phylogeny of relatedness between these different types of trees, and I was like, oh no, it definitely made some big jumps there. And of course, that isn't as crazy because these trees are dead, of course, and so there are many cosmopolitan wood decay fungus out there. That relationship is not as close when the tree is already dead. That relationship tends to be a lot closer and phylogenetically relevant when the tree is living, you know, like it's a living relationship between the fungus and the tree. But even still, I think you can understand my point that when you see it on mostly one type of tree and you know that it also grew on elm in its native range, not the only tree it grew on its native range, but predominantly elm there as well, you just start to get a little bit shocked every new species you see it growing on. I think about every new tree it's growing on as being a new sector of carbon that it is now able to release back into the environment.
Maybe that leads me to my next point I'd like you to address is, what do we need to do to raise awareness or to safeguard our ecosystems from these sorts of threats? Are there precautions that can be taken? Is there maybe some form of a better control or regulation that needs to be placed on this willy-nilly dispersal of non-native, potentially damaging organisms? Are we missing kind of that opportunity by not having a system in place to deal with it with prevention rather than trying to go the restoration or clean up after the mess we've made?
Yeah, I think that is a big part of it, that there's not exactly a system in place yet. But I think the important thing is that these conversations have now started. How do I say, regulatory bodies like APHIS or the DNR, these conversations are all happening and now they're underway, which is, I think, an amazing thing. It is the hurdle to get over, like you said, is not having ever had a policy in place like this before. And maybe I actually shouldn't say that too lightly, because we do have the practice of preventing the movement or the sale of certain plant pathogens or of certain types of invasive plants. So I do really believe that there is a solid foundation already there that would just need to be borrowed and then scratch out plant and write, you know, fungus, or scratch out plant pathogen and write mushroom or whatever it is. And so I think it's getting there. And I think a big part of the way to respond to this is to have conversations about it first and foremost, right? Your average person that you're going to walk past on the street is going to be like, invasive mushrooms? What? Like, I did not know that they could be like that. This is just speculation, but I think it's because we have this idea of fungi as being in this black box of the soil or in this invisible box of the air. And both of those are these continuous landscapes that we don't totally think of as having endemism with, right? But the truth of it is that within the mycology community, we actually totally do have concepts of endemism. We have mushrooms of the Pacific Northwest, mushrooms of the Northeastern United States, right? We have all of our lovely mushroom guides that do actually show us that there are certain mushrooms we expect to find in a certain place, and that our mycological traditions across so many regions of the world have done the tough job of documenting this has been here for the last 100 or 200 years, and this other thing just showed up 5 years ago, which in and of itself is a big part of trying to identify whether a fungus is introduced to a place or not, because sometimes we don't always have those records. At the end of all of this, one of the reasons I think I have ended up on the preventative side more so than the restorative side is that in this case of invasive fungi, at the moment, there is no solving the problem. There is no way to take it out of the environment because once it's there forever, right? It's mycelium, its spores are in the soil, in the wood. You cannot get it back out of the environment. It's different from other invasive species in that way. Like, at least you could theoretically get carp out of a place, but truly with fungi, there is no hypothetical way to get it out of the environment. And there's no biocontrol of it.
Yeah. Aishwarya, we could talk with you all day. I mean, I could certainly talk to you all day about this stuff. But I just want to mention before we end that I installed Mushroom Observer on my smartphone last night.
Nice.
And I'm going to start cataloging the land where I live. It's entirely wooded, but I know I've been hiking here for about a year, and I know it's loaded with mushrooms. But that was actually my first introduction to the Mushroom Observer app. So I'm going to start doing that. And I want to thank you for your enthusiasm for fungi. You know, I'm a kindred spirit in that way, that yeah. I'm very enthusiastic about fungi. I've been making my own tempeh, which is rhizopus mold.
Oh, wow.
I've been making tempeh since 1977. I've been growing my own tempeh. So I'm really into fungi. I've grown a lot of different kinds, but it's so nice to talk to a fellow fungus head
yeah.
and mycologist. And your exuberance is really overflowing with, you know, not just the downside of this, but your love of, obviously, love of nature and love of fungi and living organisms and the ecology and everything. And I'm really happy to have you on the show and wish you the best of luck getting your PhD
yes.
and continuing your studies and bringing enlightenment, you know, to the rest of the population who often doesn't think like Aldo Leopold, thinking like a mountain. And clearly you're one of those people that is thinking below ground in this case, similar to the way I think. I think a lot of stuff is happening below ground and most people are not paying attention to it. They're just walking on it. So it's great, great to spend time with someone who has that awareness, and wish you the best of luck. And thanks so much for being on the Enviro Show.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you so, so much. Yeah, likewise. We could talk all day, and it is very special to spend this time with someone who also enjoys the weird, crazy colors and shapes and things that fungi do.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
Well, that was excellent. Glenn, you never told me that you were a big fan of shrooms. It's amazing. I'm learning new things about you after all this time.
Well, doesn't it seem likely that I ate a lot of mushrooms at one point in my younger existence?
I guess so.
Maybe too many, but I don't know. You know, it's actually now coming to light that many of the fungi, especially the hallucinogenic ones, have therapeutic value. And I'm going to say that I ate just the right amount of mushrooms, and I knew when to stop. I knew when I had kind of cultured my brain to a certain extent, and I was really into fungi, no doubt about it. And I still am. I consider myself an amateur mycologist. So it was great talking with Aishwarya, and I'm going to try to follow her and see what she's up to as far as doing more science, because I think she's an up-and-coming, like, brilliant scientist.
I think you're right. I look forward to her return to the show. Okay. So we'll move on to the bus stop billboard and remind listeners that the top of the bus stop billboard is filled with events and actions in regard to what's going on in Washington, especially the White House. And it's long and detailed. So check that out. And then I think I'll start out with Thursday, January 8th, 3 to 4 p.m. It's Indivisible, What's New for the New Year? Oh, you'll want to know about that. So go to the blog and click on the link for that.
And Sunday, January 11th from 1 to 3 p.m., it's Share the Light Community, Warm Soup, Good Company, and Songs of Solidarity. And that's at the Wendell Meeting House in Wendell, downtown Wendell Center. There's a link, and you need to RSVP for that. So go to the blog, click on the link.
Okay, and here's something we've covered in past shows. Thursday, January 15th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., Policy and Power, New Nuclear Massachusetts? Question mark. A Sierra Club conversation with the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs. Join Massachusetts Sierra Club leaders in conversation with Melissa Lavinson, Executive Director of the Office of Energy Transformation, and Wisa Nara, Deputy Secretary for Federal and Regional Energy Affairs. And the dialogue will focus on Governor Healey's proposed legislation to expand nuclear power's contribution to the Commonwealth's energy supply portfolio while eliminating the requirement for statewide referendum on any new nuclear plant sited in Massachusetts. So go to the blog and RSVP for that one.
That's I'm going to say, you know, in general, the Enviro Show, if I can speak on behalf of the Enviro Show, we are not in favor of eliminating the statewide referendum for nuke plants. I'm sorry, but we'll draw a line in the sand there and say no nukes are good nukes. So let's have no nukes.
Exactly. So you'll want to go on that one, Enviro Show listeners. And a reminder, we update the blog and the bus stop billboard almost daily, and I'm sure there'll be new events coming in the new year.
You know, I do have some sort of breaking news, and that is that our forest protection bills have been making their way through the legislature. So that's the one to stop logging on state-owned forests and parks,
right,
and also the proposed legislation to stop logging in the watershed lands around the Quabbin, Ware River, and Wachusett reservoirs. And those bills were supposed to be reported out after the hearing, but they have been granted extensions now so that they will continue to be considered and debated through the legislative process. So those bills have all been granted extensions, which is good. They're not dead. They're still continuing and they can still be advocated for. So that's something that we're going to continue to talk about on this show. We need to pass that legislation.
Definitely.
In order to protect nature, right, and cut off the illegal logging that's happening throughout our state-owned lands being done by out-of-control outlaw state agencies such as DCR and DFW, Mass Wildlife, and those agencies that are violating the law every time they cut down trees.
Yeah, violating the laws of nature too. Okay, on that note, this is Dio saying adios, but there is one more thing. Glenn, what am I forgetting?
You're forgetting that we all need to, especially in the new year, listen to your mother.
Yes, there it is.
Yeah. Yep. I'm Glenn Ayers, and Happy New Year, folks, and take care.
Adios. See you next year.
I am Mother Earth, and I approve of this message.